Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode. I am Michael Petro, and on the show this week, we got a treat for you. We have composer, orchestrator, and conductor, Canadian Tim Williams is on the show. Tim came across me, or on, I should say, my Facebook feed, and had done some work on a film called The Swearing Jar, which just premiered last Sunday at Toronto International Film Festival. Go online, see what you can find out about it. Keep that on your radar. That's going to be a film to watch out for this year, ladies and gentlemen. We talked about how he got his start in music and then transferring into film. His breakout role, here's an example, Zack Snyder, 300. Maybe you've heard of that little ditty. Also doing work for Marvel on Guardians of the Galaxy and Deadpool. What else has he done? Hobbs and Shaw, Get Out with Jordan Peele. He also does the video games, being asked by Robert Duvall to do Wild Horses, one of his first cracks at doing a full score. So many things were talked about. Thank you again, Tim, for coming on the show. I love a free education. The guy's full of knowledge. So here's a treat for you guys. Honestly, you get to find out the Marvel process just a little bit, just a little nugget of it, how they do what they do and why they do it so well and how he got to be involved in it. So that's who's on the show. That's what's on the show. Stay tuned. We've got some things coming up. We're going to get back out there this fall. So the only way you're going to find out about that is if you follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or the Twitter machine, The Real Debaters Pod. Super easy to find. Follow us on one of those things. Chances are you'll find out what's going on. I have nothing else for you this week, ladies and gentlemen, so I will cue that reel. You enjoy Tim Williams, and I give you the show.
Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel. Here is a motion picture film, 1,000 feet, 16,000 separate photographs.
Welcome, everybody, to the official space section of the charter.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Sir, you're out of order.
Out of order.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Real Debaters. Welcome back to the podcast. Welcome back to the show. Welcome to the place that asks that lovely question, what happens when real life meets real life? And today is one of those examples, ladies and gentlemen. I have a real life composer on the show, and his name is Tim Williams. Do I have that correct? Did I remember correct?
You did.
Perfect. So first of all, Tim, thank you so much for saying yes. I saw you pop up because you've been doing some work with Farpoint, with Swearing Jar. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Yeah.
Yeah. I got to do a thing with them recently for Ice Vikings, the show they do with the ice.
Yeah, that looks great. Yeah.
Super fun show to watch. If like it's on Cottage Life, the streaming app. And I think it's on Apple, too. You can get it almost anywhere, but, like, it's all about these who go out in the middle of Lake Manitoba and go fishing at minus 40, and I got to sit on the beach that's attached to the water that they fish on and host a panel with the guys from Farpoint and the guys from...
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was, like, the sunset was right behind us, and dumbass me forgot to bring a pair of pants, so I was shivering in my shorts, like, oh, yeah, there's a colder temperature by the water, Michael. You should know these things. So that's my little connection to Farpoint. Plus Ian Bawa, one of the guys on the show, does a lot of work with them. They're doing something with his short called Strong Sun. They're trying to get
that exciting
going.
Oh, cool.
And then my other buddy Steve Taylor directs for them. So there's a Farpoint love on the
nice.
Show here.
Nice. Well, Swearing Jar is absolutely one of my favorite movies, and that I've had the pleasure to work on. And it also ticked one of my bucket list items, which was to have lunch with Kathleen Turner.
Ah!
Which, since I was a kid, has always been one of those bucket list items where you're like,
sure.
Will it ever turn out that I get a call that says Kathleen Turner's coming over for lunch, you know, and wants to chat with you. And it ended up, I was like, okay, that's a bizarre one on the list to tick, but absolutely. And we had a blast. She's such an incredible woman. And she went through we spent a couple hours together, and she went through her whole like history of everything she's done.
Wow.
And it was one of those moments that, you know, you just know you're going to treasure for the rest of your life. And she plays the mom in the film, and she almost steals the film. She's so good. She is so funny. There's some great material written for her. So it's a great film. It's premiering at the Toronto International Film Festival.
Right. I know. I caught that too.
Yeah. Which I'm really excited about. So I'm hoping to get up to Toronto to see it. And I also have Pearl, which is the prequel to X, Ty West's film, which I co-scored with Tyler Bates. That is actually also playing there in the Midnight Madness series. So two films at TIFF is always exciting.
Yeah. That's don't downplay that, sir. That's yeah. And you're at both ends. Like you're in the feature category and the Midnight Madness category. Like that's, I've been, next year, a buddy of mine and me, we've been talking, I was like TIFF or South by Southwest. And I think we're going to do South by Southwest. Cause he's like, you need to go to Austin. And just to compact music, film, and television all into one. And I know that's kind of an incubator for some stuff that's almost ready to get greenlit or like is looking for financing. So I'd rather be on that end, to start and then eventually go hobnob with all you cool people at TIFF.
Yeah. Well, South by Southwest for me was another one of those bucket list things where Robert Duvall asked me to score his film.
Yes.
He directed this film called Wild Horses with James Franco and Josh Hartnett. And again, it was insanely surreal. I was terrified when he turned up to my studio because I was imagining, you know, the consigliere from, you know, I was like, I better get it right. Otherwise, you know, I'll be found at the bottom of some lake.
Yeah, you know, sleeping with the fishes.
Sleeping with the fishes. And it ended up premiering there. So I went out, I'm thinking this maybe it was 6 years ago now, to South by Southwest, and just had a great time hanging with both him and Josh Hartnett. Unfortunately, James Franco didn't make it out because he's another person that'd be really cool to meet. But Robert Duvall called me the music man. He was like, "Hey, it's the music man."
Oh God! Yeah. Oh my God! Yeah, you're right. Like you know they're people, but you were introduced to them via The Godfather. And
Apocalypse Now.
Love the smell of napalm in the morning.
This guy's coming over to my studio. I was terrified.
Well, even other stuff, like as he's aged too, like I just watched We on the Night and as the grizzly old police chief, right? Like there's, and like Gone in 60 Seconds where he's like the grizzly old mechanic, right? Like you can never get enough of that, man.
But he's super sweet as a real life person, and took me out for a couple lunches too, which was really sweet. He's not based in Hollywood. He lives out in the East Coast, so I actually don't get to see him too much.
You've already kind of ticked off what it was like to sit in front of Robert Duvall for me, so thank you very much. But we'll revisit that because Wild Horses, that's I want to ask you about scoring a whole film versus the piecework that composers do. You know, you get the best of both worlds. But we can't find out all the big juicy tentpole stuff unless we kind of find out how, first of all, music entered your life and then how the combination of music and film met later on. So when did you find notes? When did you find scales?
So for me, music was something, I think I'm like a seventh generation musician in my family. Music's always been very important. I was born in England and my parents, grandparents, great grandparents were all like, music was serious, serious, serious. And I think I was probably one of the few that kind of screwed around a lot, you know, like I was doing classical piano, but I loved, you know, Scott Joplin. I loved Elton John. I loved Billy Joel. I spent as much time practicing that stuff. I loved Oscar Peterson. And so I would play as much Oscar Peterson as every, and I'd always get in trouble. I was always being yelled at because I was supposed to be doing scales and practicing, you know, the real sort of important works. And I'm like, well, these are important works. You know, I love the old Beatles stuff. And so
Candle in the Wind is just as important as, you know, Johann Sebastian Bach's Ninth, whatever, that I don't know. I know both of them. They both hit differently, but they're both important.
Well, music's music, isn't it? It's about the way to communicate. It's about communicating mood and tone and emotion, which is why it's such a powerful thing for film and visual media as well. But I grew up in Toronto and then I moved out to Victoria, BC. And I got into the industry because I was playing piano at the school, and there was a LA director that came up to shoot like a teen drama at our school.
Okay.
And he heard me playing the piano and he came over, and they had a composer on the film, but they said, would you be interested in writing some music for this film?
How old were you?
I must have been like, I don't know, maybe 16 at the
time.
Yeah. And I just had, I had such a great time doing it. Bo Harwood was the composer on it. And we had, they had one of the local Victoria bands also kind of featured in it. I'm trying to remember the name of the band. It was a while back, so it's eluding me. But it was a really good kind of local Victoria BC band, and they're pretty heavily featured in it. So for me, it was just a really great introduction into film scoring, and I ended up backburnering it for quite a while because I ended up doing. I went into musical theater initially, and I had a show that I wrote that went to that opened at the Elgin Theater in Toronto back in 1994. The producers Cats kind of got behind it, and for those of you who were around in 1994,
I wasn't there, but I know what you're talking about. Yeah, Cats was a big deal back then.
And Dan Hill did a cover of one of the songs, which for me was pretty cool.
Sure.
And then it went to London in 2000, and to the West End, and they did a big production of it there. But, there's an old adage about theater, which is you can make a killing in theater, but you can't make a living. And unfortunately, my experience with theater was in the second category. So I sat there and said, okay, I have a kid on the way. I better figure something out with my life.
Yeah,
and I'd always had this, I'd always had this kind of, you know, that film experience had really, had really connected with me, and sure. It was something I wanted to do. So, in 2000, I moved to LA. I figured this would be the place to try and break into film scoring.
Yeah,
and
so did everybody else, I imagine.
and thankfully. I think I've done 140 movies now, something like that.
It's a long list, sir. You're not an easy research. Yeah. And by that, I mean, I want to talk about this. Oh my God, he did that. Holy shit, he's done everything. What the fuck do I ask this man?
But yeah, you know, and part of it was moving to LA. One of the things I really like about LA is there's an incredible community of people here. So, you tend to sort of run into people, but there's just a, you know, I've learned more probably in the last 20 years living here in LA from watching other people who are great at the craft do it and collaborating with people in the industry than I have in my entire sort of, you know, musical, like the music that I was taught and all the kind of university courses and stuff like that really didn't prepare me or didn't teach me anything about.
Well, it's like an incubator out there, I imagine, because it's the Mecca. Everybody's going there for their, yeah, for their craft. And because there's, yeah, so many moving parts to a film or a show or a video game, even, you know, there's a lot of you. So you can bounce ideas, I imagine. And then everyone's like a stone's throw away kind of shit.
Exactly. So there's quite a collaborative, you know, group. And as well, you've also got the top musicians here. You know, I'm working on a series right now, and every week we work with Gil Sharon, the drummer, you know, who's Marilyn Manson's drummer and is touring right now, with Jerry Cantrell. Jesus. But yeah, Gil's like one of the top drummers in the world, and he drums, you know, we work usually once or twice a week. I'll have him into the studio to record him, and you know, same with guitarists and bassists, and just the exposure to, you know, people who are at that level. Like just for fun today, I was having lunch with Lisbeth Scott, and you would, if you've ever seen like the Passion of the Christ movie, yes, there's that incredibly haunting vocal on that. She's also in Munich. She's also the vocalist in like maybe 10 of the huge feature films. You hear this that incredible sort of, it almost sounds like it's Middle Eastern vocals.
Yep.
That's Lisbeth. She's insane. Oh. She's just an insanely great vocalist. But she's been a close friend for 10, 15 years, but just meeting her for lunch and catching up and hearing some of her latest work that she's working with Nate Barr in a vampire movie, so for a Stephen King vampire movie. So I'm like, that's play me some of that. So yeah. I'm hearing all the stuff that she's doing for that. And, you know, I think that's for me has been one of the best things. 'Cause you're just not in a vacuum. You're yeah. able to really get inspired by the people here and hear the different, you know, I also have the great privilege of not just writing music, but orchestrating for people, which is where I take what they do and write out all the parts for the players, for the orchestra.
You get to make the sausage and then you get to play.
Right.
Actually, that's a bad analogy. You get to make the sausage and then you get to find all the ingredients that put it all together.
Right. So in that capacity, I'm often hearing, you know, what other composers like, I'm like, what is that sound? What is that synth? What is this? You know, so you every week I hear something different and I'm like, that's awesome. How did you come up with that? Or how are you doing that? And I think that's such a unique thing about LA is that it is this incubator of stuff. And there's this, I guess it's like being in New York for fashion. You know, you're always seeing the latest, whatever's going down the runway. And LA has some really amazing stuff going on all the time that you can learn from and listen to and, you know.
Oh no, that. I think of convincing my wife once a week to move to LA and then I just realized the logistics and there's not enough anxiety meds out there in the world to keep me at base. So I use the video conferencing tools at my disposal and talk to the ones I that say yes, like you, sir. So we get this pitch at 16. I love it, man. Like I ask the same question to everybody. I'm like, so what, you were doing a thing, because in some way, shape or form, like almost everything in life, like engineering, you could go and work on a film set. Gymnastics, you could go figure out how to work on a film set.
Right.
Your piano player, you can compose a film. Like something in life always kind of finds you in that way. And I always ask people, but you're just like, yeah, I got pitched when I was 16 to compose on the spot. Like that's a movie in and of itself. So with everything in film, you start at the bottom. You have to work your way up. You have to showcase your talents. When did you really start to find your footing in this industry? What project? What song? Like what really defined you as like, okay, let's ride this, see how long it can go.
Well, I still don't know that I found my footing.
Oh, come on. I'm looking at the Watchmen and 300 posters on the back there, man. I know, like, you found your footing. You've worked with Zack Snyder. You've worked with Jordan Peele. You've worked with Marvel. Like, you found your footing. I would say that you're making a new path.
But I would say the project that really started probably to turn things around a little bit for me was 300. That was, you know, and again, I wasn't the lead composer on that. Tyler Bates was, but Tyler Bates was my neighbor. So, you know, one of the early jobs I got in when I moved to LA was I do a ton and I still do a ton of the live Disney stuff. So if you've ever been to a Disney cruise ship, a Disney park, Disney, any of those, a lot of the shows,
really?
I create a lot of those shows. And that was sort of an offshoot of, you know, when I moved from London, the director of my show in London, her first job was creating the live version of Aladdin.
Oh,
so she
no small had, feat.
Yeah, so she had me come in and arrange this, what's become the kind of the touring production at the parks and on the boats, on the ships, version of Aladdin. And I got to work with Alan Menken and hit one of my first jobs. I have a new song for this. Can you orchestrate it? I'm like, really? I'm orchestrating for Alan Menken. This is pretty, pretty amazing. But Tyler, who was my neighbor, heard these huge kind of Disney arrangements exploding out of my studio in the back and his studio is in the back. So we got to talking and the first film we kind of worked where he's like, could you orchestrate for me initially? I was like, of course, you know, and we did the James Gunn film Slither. That was pretty much the first thing we worked on. And he said, yeah, I've got this Zack Snyder film. We're just in previs right now. It's called 300. And we're looking at going to Abbey Road to record it. Would you orchestrate it for me? And I ended up doing some additional music on it too, because he spent almost a year on the score, but it's an epic score. It's just a genre defining score. Like, there's nothing out there. There was nothing like it. I don't know that there's been anything since it, but it was this thing of using, you know, Azam for vocals, hand percussion. Greg Ellis came in and did these incredible sort of hand percussion things using orchestra in a way that I'd never heard it being used. And then adding sort of rock guitars and drums, all kind of hybridized together in a way that created this landscape that wasn't around at the time. There was nothing like it. And, we were pretty burnt out. And so by the time we got to kind of the big last scene in it, where it's the overhead shot of them all dead, and then there's that big rousing speech that finishes it.
Yeah.
He was like, I'm really, really tired. I we got to get catch a plane to go to Abbey Road and record this. And we were recording this in 2 days. I don't know what to do. He said, do you have any ideas? So I began to sort of play some stuff, and he's like, yeah, I like it. You know, so we basically wrote that whole end sequence.
Wow.
In that morning. We got on the plane in the afternoon. I orchestrated it on the flight. We touched down in England, and then I sent it off to the copyists, and then we played it for the director next day, and Zach loved it. And Zach was like, I think we ended up doing like 3 takes of it. I said, I'd love to do it in one take. I know it's a 3-4 minute piece of music. I said, but it just builds and builds and builds. And I don't want to stop and start. And the first time we did it, we blew out the room because there's so many trumpets at the end. It got huge.
It's horn heavy. I know that I've watched that movie easily 20 times, and I know what you're talking about. The rock combined with the symphony and the hard guitar in the battle scenes, and just it's beautiful.
So we blew it out the first time. Everything went into the red. So we're like, can you tell the horns to back off a little bit? You know, we'll adjust our gains here. And so I think we did it a second time, and I think Zach had maybe 1 or 2 more notes about a couple transitions. And then I think the third take is what you hear in the film. And it was, again, for me, it was the first time I'd really conducted. It was the first time I'd ever orchestrated anything. And I remember the very end of the film is something like 6 trombones on a single note, that final hit out as you go to credits. And I had no idea what that would sound like. And, you know, I just was like, I hope this works, but I've never done 6 trombones on a single note before. And it's dark and heavy and yeah, it was fun. So I think for me, that was definitely one of the highlights, one of those bucket list moments. I'm like, okay, it's first time orchestrating something big. It was massive orchestra. It was maybe like 80 piece orchestra. I'd foolishly hired a choir of 60. I mean, now we would hire a choir of say 24 and malt it. You do a couple of tracks, but I didn't know that. It was my first thing. And I was sitting there going, it's a big film. It does 60 seems like about the right size for, you know, cause I was coming from live, you know, choirs and musical theater.
You wanted to hit the back of the room.
I wanted it to be big, you know, I was like, and the other thing that we struggled a little bit with this was, the choir sounded very much like a British church choir, and they're meant to sound like sort of Xerxes' horde. And it was, for me, one of the first challenges. It was like, I was so green and inexperienced, but I knew that the music supervisor was sitting in the booth looking concerned, you know, Tyler was in the booth looking concerned. And so I just turned to this group of 60 and I said, I want you just all just to like scream at me and see if you can terrify me. And so this rather perplexed group of 60 sort of singers, you know, sort of went, law, you know,
and yeah,
I'm like, scream. And then finally they got to the place where they're going, ugh, and just screaming, screaming at me. And I said, now sing it like that. Just sing it right away. Sing it like you just screamed at me. And so that whole Genove that created was like that. But it took me 15 minutes of them screaming at me to try and get them out of singing it like a very polished British choir,
like, you know, a hymn.
Like a hymn, exactly. And you know, it took a while, but I wanted them to sort of give it way more of a almost a death metal approach to the sound of the choir, so it sounded like the Persians and something that should be terrifying, not beautiful, you know.
Well, yeah, no, now like knowing this, like I remember the first time I saw 300 and I visually was just like, you're blown away on all your senses, because you're right, like it stops and becomes almost art during its stop motion.
It does.
And the music is a combination of contemporary and classic, and like you're saying, now knowing like almost a screamed note, like it's a cacophony, if you can say it, but it's so beautifully put together in such care with each scene that, like, yeah, man, no, you just,
and well, Tyler spent a year on it, you know, and
is that natural? Like, is there a time?
That's very, very long for a film. I mean, we're lucky if we get 3 months on a film. So a year was really nice, but I think it's one of those scores you can really tell. I mean, the head of music at the time turned to him and just said, you know, you can hear the year you've, the care and attention to detail you've put into this is staggering. It was a landmark score. And I think, for me, it was one of those things where I really did start to get loads of emails and loads of people kind of going, oh, that was a little bit of a turning point. From there on out, there was a lot of kind of fun stuff. We did obviously Watchmen, the film was a fun, and Sucker Punch was a blast.
So you and Zach have a history together, obviously.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, in terms of those bigger films, I think certainly Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2 were both great sort of bucket list things, but from a different perspective, because
sure.
we were coming off, I think, Watchmen when we jumped onto Guardians, and, you know, Guardians, our first pass of Guardians, the notes were, this is really dark and heavy, and that's not what it should be. This film is much more like a space opera.
Yeah, can you? Okay, so everything I kind of put down, I listened to before, just to kind of get a just to have it fresh, and I can't, like, the your track Dad was that for Guardians 2.
Yeah,
when is that being played? Is that being played when he kills Ego, or is that being played when he meets Ego?
The dad theme. I'm going to have to do a little research here to remind myself of that one. But I know the original, there was an original father-son theme that we had for Kurt Russell and Chris Pratt, that was when they're doing that, almost like they're playing a game of baseball, tossing
yes,
it back.
Yes.
And that was, you know, there was a theme. But if I'm correct, I'm pretty sure Dad is the theme when actually Yondu is taken up into the and dies, and
that's,
I'm pretty sure that's what it is. And that was
I thought it was too. I went through three tracks.
And there's was like, I'm there's sure a really great clip of that James Gunn posted of us recording that. He did a live Facebook post from Abbey Road when we recorded that track. And I'm conducting it. So he sort of turns the camera onto me conducting it. And you see the full orchestra, which is massive. I mean, I think we had something like 21 brass. And I think we had 3 tubas that day, because our copyist is a great tuba player. And I normally like 2 tubas anyway, just because, you know. And he was like, oh, do you mind if I go out and play tuba with this band? It's such a good band. We're like, 3 tubas. Nothing I've heard of has ever had 3 tubas. Go for it. So, we said to him, go for it. So he went out. So when you look down, you see these 3 massive honking tubas that are just like in the boots, like on the bass. But it's that really powerful moment where Yondu basically gives his life for Chris, and I'm pretty sure that's the cue, but that was such a you know, the secret to, I think, to Guardians was shifting into more, thinking more almost like classic John Williams type score.
Oh, yes, sir.
You know, that was kind of where our brains was like, okay, so that's what this is. So.
It's so beautiful, Tim. Like, it's like, you just, the strings and the, it's just so haunting and so reminiscent of space opera, right? Different team.
Exactly what the reference was. I remember the main theme from that, you may or may not remember, is, but it's a really catchy theme that Tyler wrote. It's the dun 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 dun.
Yes. Diddle, yep. Diddle, yep. Diddle.
And I remember he sent me a tape of it, and he was playing it on the guitar, and I was like, that's what a great theme. And we were desperately trying to find a way to take the theme and make it so that in the first movie, when they all come together in that jail cell, they have that great scene where they take over the jail.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a whole escape sequence.
Yep.
And it's the first time they come together, and Groot's smashing some guy, and it's like this really sort of gnarly bunch of people, but they're kind of like, you know,
yeah.
It's the first time you see the Guardians, and it was really important that we had their theme on that moment. So I kind of thought, well, why don't we try it almost with like that sort of Gustav Holst planet, which John Williams sort of takes a lot. It's that kind of martial cadence of, you know, dun da 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 dun da 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 dun dun da da dun dun da da dun dun da da dun da 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 da.
It gets you going, right? It's
dum dum. Yeah.
100%.
So I threw that sort of approach underneath it with all the strings and the brass and everything, and then just put the themes. You know, we had four trumpets and eight horns on the theme, and then all the lower trombones are kind of doing that bum bum ba da 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 dum da da dum. You know, that you've
it's
heard
the
in
superhero Indiana Jones, thing. Yeah.
Heard it in.
Yes.
It's a good throwback, and Marvel loved it. They just said it's. I mean, they still say it's one of the best themes. Oh. Of their whole franchise, but it's I thought it really worked well, and then from there, once we had that theme and that feel, then we were able to kind of just take that and weave it through everything, and then obviously with the second movie, it was great to even kind of just start with a huge statement of that theme as it zooms into that
the opening battle, yep,
at the opening battle with that creature, so. You know, those were, you know, definitely really, really fond memories. Again, sort of bucket list moments, both recorded at Abbey Road, which
can I interject for a second? And I don't want to get the lead here and be the guy in Winnipeg, Manitoba, because I listened to enough of my favorite podcasts to know, but I know there is a process with Marvel, and like Pepsi and Coke, no one knows the secret. No one ever will. But what is that process like? What is it akin to? Because the Marvel machine is a different kind of cinema altogether, and being able to bring it to life and introduce such great characters. Like Guardians is such a revered, it's got a love story within a love story. The James Gunn aspect of coming and going. Like there's so many great parts to the Guardians series. What's the Marvel experience like in that regard? What were you so shocked by, maybe?
Well, I mean, the thing that was, again, I don't know if it's just kind of like the underdog in me, but I love the underdog story. And 300 was an underdog story. People don't realize it, but 300 was an underdog story. We'd had Alexander and I think, what was the other one? Troy.
Yep.
That had not done well at the box office. And people were basically saying the Sword and Sandals film is dead. So Warner's was really nervous.
How dare
they?
That's one of the four pillars of old Hollywood.
And it was one of those things where Zach had strong-armed them by saying, I won't do Watchmen unless you give me some money for 300. And they said, okay, here's 80 million, go and make it up in Canada. So, yeah, I mean, that's truthful. And then it started testing through the roof, and everyone's sitting there going, it's testing at 92. I think we have a hit on our hands. It was a huge surprise. And Guardians fell in that same category. You know, there's the Marvel characters that everyone knows and loves, but we were sitting there going, okay, we've got a tree, we've got a raccoon, you know, we've got a, you know, a quirky lead guy from Parks and Rec, you know, we've got a green girl, a purple girl, and a blue guy. Yeah. And you're just sitting there going, this does not seem, you know, and to add it, and to top it off, the tree only says, "I am Groot." That's the only dialogue through the entire film that he has. He doesn't say anything but, "I am Groot." That's Groot. All he says. So we sat there going, it was the underdog story. And I think James Gunn said something along the lines of, if Marvel is the Beatles, this is the Rolling Stones.
Ooh.
and so again, we had no idea how, whether it was going to do well or not. We just had a blast writing it. But that said, the Marvel process is a very, very intense process to go through, because the level that they want to hit is so high that the number of revisions and edits to the film, it goes through the roof. I remember one day we were working, and they said, "Oh, here's a cut," and then that afternoon they said, "Here's the revised cut," and we were just like, we don't know which one we're supposed to be looking at.
Yeah.
And then 3 days later it was, you know, and it's not just, they're not just removing material, scenes are getting swapped, scenes are getting shortened. I always describe it a bit like trying to create a custom made suit for a jogger, you know.
Yeah.
who's carb loading and gaining tons of weight and then losing tons of weight, and you're trying to, while they're jogging, you're trying to create this really nice suit for them. So it's a very challenging process, because even with a cue that you nail and then you gets approved and everybody's happy, you can see the same cue a week later now as 20 seconds of a scene that's been cut down.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there going, this music doesn't work anymore. And so you rewrite it. And then 4 weeks later, the original scene gets put back in again. And they're like, yeah, we don't have music. And you've got to find, you got to go back versions. And there's like the whole back end of Guardians. Like there's a whole long sequence of battles where they basically cut a bunch of tracks together, and we were going to record it at Abbey Road, but it was all bits and pieces from all different tracks, and I had to sit there and work it out and create all the orchestrations to go and record it, when all I had was just audio, and it had all been cut together by the music editor. And they're like, "Oh, we love this track," and I'm like, "Well, it's actually not a track any of us wrote. The music editor's done it."
Yeah.
And it does sound great, but how are we going to record this? Because I have no, you know, I sort of thought, well, I guess it's 6 bars from this cue and 8 bars from this cue. And, you know, and they were like, yeah, and we pitch shifted it too to make it all work together. So it's an exhausting process. Like you finish it and you're like, I need a month off at least, because you're completely spent. And it's, you know, it's a good 6 to 8 months of intense, you know, detailed work. So
you're flexing all your creative muscles all the time, 7 days yeah. a week, kind of. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean,
yeah.
It shows, sir.
It's a tough process. Unlike a lot of other projects where it's not, it's just not that intense. Things don't come at you quite so quickly, but on these bigger, on these types of movies, the Marvel movies, the Guardians 1 and 2, they were coming so fast and furious, and you're constantly, you know, that's the worst part. You write a cue that works great, but then you're having to try and reconform it to make it work with a new cut. And then you get another cut, and now your reconform doesn't work. So, I remember one cue, we had like something like 46 versions of it by the time we got the dub stage. And it's the same 4-minute cue, but we've got 46 versions. So just you do the math on that. That's 4 minutes times 46 for one cue.
That and I mean, to anybody who doesn't read sheet music or understand timing or any of that stuff, I mean, that's the 4 minutes. Yeah, sure, it's a commercial break, but that's a fuck ton of music.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You mentioned reformatting and cutting and editing. I'm really interested with all of these things, what your process is like. like, we'll come back to the movie stuff, because, man, you were full of some awesome fucking stories. I love it. And, like, specifically about the things that are lore to me. Like, I'm a shill. That's my kind of position on the show. I like everything. I'll find the great in everything. I'll always try to prop it up and never bring it down. Unless, I mean, it's hot dog shit. That's a different conversation. That's a different episode. But with what you do, what do you do? What's a day in the office like for you when you get a new project? How do you approach it? What's your toolbox? How does it all come together?
Yeah. So the hardest thing about writing for film or TV, is tone. You know, people say, "Oh, is it hard to write a theme? Is it hard to score?" No, that part of stuff. It's always hard to write a theme, but it's finding the tone that fits the film. And that was, like, Guardians was a great example of that. We were kind of coming in with a Watchmen tone, and they were like, "No, this is too dark. It's not the right tone." And I think that's one of the challenges that you try and discuss with the director right at the very beginning, is what kind of music works with your film. Like, because really what you're doing is you're storytelling through music is what film scoring is. You're trying to convey either what's being shown, or sometimes you're trying to convey what's not being shown, but you're, you know, especially when you, with some of the horror stuff I do, you're letting the audience know something's about to happen before it's happened, or, you know, you're hinting to the audience something's not right here.
Right on my shirt. Yeah. Right? Like, two notes. And yeah. And as they progress, I totally get it now. Go on. Sorry.
So for me, that to me is the hardest part, is when I start a film, I sit there and I write a bunch of cues, and we'll work with the director, and I'll say something like this. You know, when I worked on Brightburn, with Dave Yarvo, you know, that was an especially difficult film, because I don't know how many of you have seen Brightburn, but it's a cool premise. It's written by James's brothers, and James Gunn was the producer on it. But the premise was, what if Superman were bad? What if, instead of becoming a superhero that was good, what if he became a superhero that was bad and evil?
I remember that.
So the question with Brightburn was how much of it's superhero and how much of it's horror, and trying to create a theme that evoked, like, a superhero that was creepy and off kilter, and he starts out like a sweet little kid, so you also don't want to tip your hand too early that there's something going on here. But he is from another planet. He did come in he did arrive and crash, and his parents had adopted him, and at a certain point that nature that was inside of him began to emerge. And there's a cool line that he says, what's the difference between bees and wasps, you know? And he talks about wasps are predatory and they take over and kill everything, versus bees, which are helpful. And it was sort of a great metaphor for this kid. But that was an example of trying to find the tone. And ultimately, I just literally had to sit here in my studio with the director and ultimately said, well, why can't it just be three notes? I was like, it can be. Can we find those three notes? And we did. We sat there and I started to play him three notes, and he finally went, that's it.
Jesus.
And that became the theme, and it sort of starts as sort of like a piano thing, and then by the time the movie ends and everything, all the mayhem is broken loose, and you know, he's killing his parents, it's full trombone section playing this sort of very ominous theme, and it had expanded. But that was really, again, the hardest thing. So normally what I'll do is we'll sit down with the director, we'll go through and break the film down into cues, into sections. So he'll say, music should come in here, and we'll do this together at the beginning of the process. Music should come in here, music should come out there, I think we need music here. And then he'll say, this is the story. This is how I want the audience to feel. Maybe we're beginning to feel something slightly wrong here, or some, you know, beginning to start moving down that path of the story. This is where all hell breaks loose. You know, we need this to be violent and aggressive. This part needs to be redemptive. Near towards the end of Brightburn, his mother tries to. There's a moment there where there's almost a reconciliation, you know, and so we wanted again that. What we refer to as kind of like the family theme. In horror, I always have what I call life normal and then life fucked up, you know. So, and life normal is super important. You know, like you watch Stranger Things, it's about the kids. It's the life normal is really important in horror because it's your moment where you get to connect with characters. So you write down. You basically create a list of all the music that's needed for the film. You know, you total it up and get a sense of how much music you're going to have to write and schedule and all that kind of stuff. So, and then I'll come in and pretty much my day is going cue by cue, getting stuff written. What I'll do is I'll create a quick time for the director so he can see the music in context. I'll send it to him and say, what do you think? And then cues either get approved, or he might have some notes, or he might have some very strong notes saying, no, this is not the right direction, or it might just be, love it, but can we punch this moment more, or could we tail out better, or could we transition here better, or those kinds of comments. I've done everything from a 3-day schedule on a movie all the way up to, you know, a year schedule. And, you know, for me, more time is always better. But with more time comes more comments, you know, that's the depth of it. The general rule of thumb is the work always expands to the time you allow it. So if you give it a year, you'll be working on it for a year. If you give it 3 months, you'll be working on it for 3 months. So the deadline can be helpful in many ways because it does put sort of a finish line when the director finally has to commit and you have to commit as the composer and make those hard choices about, yeah, this cue's approved, or we're pretty close on this one.
How many dead cues are in your life? How full is your cutting room floor? It's full.
There's a lot of stuff that's gone by the wayside.
And like, does that, because I mean, everything is artistic on a set. Everything is in some form of art. It's just a moving form instead of a picture. And I mean, you know, do you try not to get married to your work?
That's a great question. And I think that's one of the hardest things that I have to deal with. I always find the cues I adore are the ones that get cut or get the most comments. The ones I get emotionally, and it's very difficult not to get emotionally attached because music is very, it's very personal. You know, when you're creating music, it's in a way you're sort of burying your soul, or there's a personal connectivity. It's not like, you know, it's not removed from you. It does somehow represent you. So it's very, that part is hard when you think a cue's really working well and you get some notes from the director and you're sitting there going, ugh, you know. We actually on Brightburn, we had that. There was, in fact, the whole end sequence, I wrote this thing that almost felt like it was almost like a Gallipoli thing, you know, like at the end of Gallipoli where Mel Gibson's going to his death, and it's this sort of, it's this very kind of slow thing that just builds and builds and builds and builds, and it was really very emotional and quite punchy, you know, it really drew you in, and it was playing the emotion through the whole scene, like a sort of a Gallipoli scene, you know, where the dad gets killed, David Denman and Denman. From The Office plays the dad, and he's phenomenal in it. And he gets his his face, his brain sort of lasered by the sun, and it all melts.
Yeah, it's a great scene, actually.
Yeah, it's an emotional scene because you know he's a really nice dad in it. That's hard. Dave Irvin and I had a long conversation about it because he loved it as well, and he sort of felt it almost felt kind of like a Godfather end moment, you know, when they're all getting killed at the end of Godfather. It had that deep sort of emotional and a very slow cadence. And he said, but I think that it needs to, I think we have to go back to the horror and the action for that sequence. Because we can't stay in the emotion. We have to go to the terror of this guy suddenly realizing his kid with all these supernatural abilities.
Devil is
going to kill him now. And he said, that's what we need to play there, as much as I love the emotion of the moment. So that was hard. I mean, again, that's one of those cases. And even the director was kind of like very, very sad about having to make that choice because he said, I love this cue, and I feel the emotional impact of it, he said. But I think we just have to change the cadence here and play the fear, play the aggression, play just the sheer terror of what's happening rather than the emotion of it. That I think is a... I mean, that happens a lot. You're right. Some really cues that you adore and somehow they don't connect or they don't serve the film in the way that the director imagines. And that's always tough, but it's part of the business. You're ultimately there to serve the film and you're there to serve the project. And
that's where tenure and you know, time in the industry, you learn that shit, I would imagine.
Yeah.
At first, it's a little jarring. I mean, anybody, you're fucking human. It's gonna suck. But then after a while, you're like, all right, yeah, you know what? I pray at the altar of this film, not my ego or not my resume. So, yeah, got it. Good.
And Get Out was sort of almost the opposite process. Get Out was one of those films where...
That's life fucked up, by the way. Whatever you did in that scene, when they're... that's life fucked up. Is that a good representation?
It is. And I basically... that was a film that Jordan had been working with Michael Abels, who wrote some beautiful stuff. But they were 2 weeks out, and they were a little bit worried about getting done. So they brought me in to finish the back half of the film. So I effectively got brought in to do the life fucked up stuff on that film. I think there's like, I do Andre's reveal and a few other, nice emotional cues, but most of the mayhem in the back half of that film is me do what I do, which is create some mayhem.
Yeah.
But we had 2 weeks on that and it had to be written. Jordan had to approve it and we had to orchestrate and deliver it to the dub. We had 2 weeks. That was it. So it was like we had to go fast on that. But Get Out was one of those films when I saw it. I've done films that have had some great traction, but I've equally done some films that I adore that never saw the light of day. One of those being History of Future Folk, by the way. If you've not seen History of Future Folk, I think it's on Netflix.
It is.
It's one of my favorite films.
It's an adorable indie darling.
It is so funny. It's so heartfelt. And Dee Schneider has a great.
He does. That's, I thought that was him.
Yeah, it is. So I got to meet him. It was like a great, and there's a picture of me, you know, with him at this talk about bucket lists. I mean, I'm sitting there going, this is a guy whose music we used to crank as kids. And there I am kind of hanging out. He's the nicest guy too. I just thought Get Out was going to be one of those History of Future Folk where it's like such a great film, but no one ever sees it. And it just, there was something very far about the reaction to it that seemed to really, I mean, you know, got nominated for Academy Awards, for goodness sake. So it was like one of those things where I was like, that was a little unexpected. But as an artist, highly exciting to have anything you work on get that kind of a you know, attention and resonate that way with people. So
that's a conversation piece film. That gets people talking film that challenges status quo thinking. Like, that does a lot of things in that film. And that's what's like, you just being a part of that as a fan to do stuff like that. I can only imagine, like, seeing that guy's process and then you getting like a crack at it. That's, yeah, not, you're just a bucket list.
Well, you know, what do we say as a kid? Go big or stay home. You
yeah.
know, that's always been, you know, I don't know. I've always enjoyed films. I grew up on like James Bond and loving John Barry, loving John Williams, loving film. I mean, you know, and for me, it was kind of I felt like I was kind of cheating the system by going into a profession where I could watch TV and movies all day long and explain to my parents, this is actually my job rather
You're
than
paid
to
well
me.
To do this.
Yeah. You know, because prior to 18, I was watching just as much TV. It's just, I wasn't getting paid for it. You
sure,
know?
Yeah.
And I thought, how can I turn this into a living? You know, how can I turn lying on a couch watching great movies? How can I turn this into something that I get paid for? You know, that's I still sometimes have to pinch myself and go, okay, this is a pretty cool job, especially when you get new, you know, when you get to see we have you know, John Wick coming up, John Wick 4. I'm just orchestrating and conducting that one. I'm not doing any writing on it, but we'll record that later this year. But I mean, I got to see a little bit of it the other day. We were doing some drum tracks for it, and It was so exciting to start to see it. So it's just an exciting process when you get to kind of see stuff way in advance and watch it down. And as an orchestrator, you know, I'll sit there on an up and coming project and get the reels and just begin to sit there. And I'll usually watch the film through, or if I'm hired as a composer, first thing you do is you sit down, you watch the film down, and you just realize it's probably going to be a year or two before people actually get to see it.
Jesus.
And you're kind of in that really exciting position of kind of getting that really early sneak peek of what the film is going to be and kind of getting to see what's coming. So that's cool.
Is it, I don't want, like, I'm, I just want to know, like, is it awesome?
It's awesome. It's awesome. It's going to be awesome.
That is,
it's
that cool. Whole,
well, like, it's going to be awesome. But yeah. And so most recently, you know, the project that I co-scored with Tyler is Pearl, which for Ty West, which is the prequel to X.
Which is like a whole different kind of horror movie, which is really good. Like, everybody I know is like, this is one of those like sleeper horrors that has so much in it that you just don't, it's a sleeper.
Yeah. And it's part of, it's going to be part of a, you know, it's part of it. It will be part of a trilogy. So, X is in the '70s. This one's set in, I think, 1914.
Oh boy.
And, it's, obviously I can't say too much about it because it's starting to premiere, but, all I can say is Mia Goth. Again, it's one of those things. If someone deserves some award recognition, Mia Goth is breathtaking in it. You know, really, really breathtaking. So
is she becoming that voice? You think, like, with you said, like 10 movies. Like, is she slowly becoming like, we need to get her? We need that sound.
I think so. I think she is. You know, she's. In X, she plays two roles. She plays Maxine and she plays Pearl, the old lady.
Yes.
And not a lot of people realize that she's playing Pearl, that she's the old lady there. You know, she did such a convincing job in both roles that people have no idea. And so this is her origin story. Pearl is how she became Pearl.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Jimmy on the show is going to lose his mind. That's his favorite movie right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, that was, it's an absolutely exquisite piece of art. You know, Ty West is a genius, and to have an opportunity to work on something like that is really exciting. So that's opening at the Venice Film Festival, then it's playing at TIFF, and then it's opening on September the 16th, so not too, about a month away.
Yeah.
That hits theaters, and I think that'll be good. And then on the flip side is Swearing Jar, which is also premiering at TIFF, which is this incredible piece that's Kate Hewlett wrote it. She's Toronto based. I've known Kate since she was 6 years old. Her brother David Hewlett, who's an actor, he's in Shape of Water, and a lot of people know him from Stargate.
David Hewlett, isn't he the one that dresses up? He's does all the like special effects, right?
David Hewlett? No, I think that's Doug Jones.
That's it. Sorry, I'm confused.
Yeah. But Doug Jones. But the and funnily enough, I did Butterfly Circus with Doug Jones. but David Hewlett's the guy with the thick glasses in Shape of Water. He's the guy, you know, the kind of the hard ass with the thick. He also plays the grumpy neighbor in Planet of the Apes, where he gets ripped apart by the monkey very early on, by Caesar. But anyway, David Hewlett, his younger sister is Kate Hewlett. She's this incredibly talented songwriter and scriptwriter, and she wrote this stunning piece about this young woman who loses her husband very early on, played by Patrick Adams from Suits. And the film, and it's her just trying to deal with the sudden loss of a husband. And she's pregnant when she loses the husband, and trying to get over that grief and move on. And Kathleen Turner plays Patrick Adams' mom. And so it's this sort of strange combination of this deep emotion with incredibly funny dialogue. You know, it's the dialogue is very, very funny, very, very witty, but there's this kind of deep, deep sadness and emotion that kind of goes through the whole film. And the whole film is told from she's a songwriter, so she does these songs, and it's got a wonderful indie vibe to it. And I got to do, ended up doing sort of a piano string score for it, and got to record that at Abbey Road at Studio 3, which is it's the iconic rock room where Sting records and where U2 records. And it's this room. It's not the big room.
Stood on the same carpet as the other greats.
And the Beatles piano sitting in there, you know, it's the Mrs. Mills piano that. So I go over and play on the Mrs. Mills piano that you hear in Hey Jude or Let It Be or Penny Lane. That's the Mrs. Mills piano that they recorded, and it's sitting right there. So I'm like, oh, this is,
holy,
you know,
fuck.
It's the coolest piano. So I flew over to London last year in the middle of COVID and got 12 string players to make it super small and intimate, and a phenomenal pianist. And we recorded the score, and then all the songs I did in Toronto, because it's all live on set. So,
oh really?
And I worked with Justin Amerdin, who's this absolutely incredible Toronto guitarist. He's phenomenal. And we recorded it and mixed it right in Toronto. And then we had to film it on set. So we did some shooting in Hamilton and some shooting in, up in Toronto, but most of it. And I remember when we were going to the, recording studio, I was driving along Queen Street, and I looked to my right, and there's the set for What We Do in the Shadows, which is one of my favorite comedies.
Yeah, and so you've got a track on it too.
I jumped out of the car. I jumped over the little fence, and of course took tons of selfies of me sitting on Nando's steps. And you know, I was like, I'm going to get arrested before I even get to the studio to do this. But
that's the fan in you, man. There's one in all of us.
But yeah, so Swearing Jar is just a beautiful, beautiful film, and the acting is stellar. But it's a very slow, almost kind of European film, and it's definitely a small indie film. But it's full of hugely talented people, and I think it's one of those things that will find a great audience. But again, very different than anything I've done before. It was fun to do something that was both produce the songs and do stuff that was kind of not the usual orchestral type stuff.
Well, that's kind of how you started, right? You wanted to play the stuff that wasn't what you were told to play. You want to make
right.
the stuff that you just want to make, right?
Yeah, and exactly. So, exactly.
Like that's in your bones, man.
Yeah.
Let's talk about you for a second here. Like if you had, you know, who do you want to score for? What filmmaker tomorrow calls you? Who do you want that call to be? Like someone you haven't worked with yet that you'd love to work with, or you admire, or you're like, that would be a challenge.
Yeah.
I'll make sure he hears it. I promise.
I think my wish is probably shared by every composer out there, but for me, I've always wanted to do a Bond film. I think that's pretty much every composer will say, I want to do a Bond film, and you know, fewer of the people who get to do it. But there
Barbara,
was something about...
if you're listening, Barbara Broccoli, this one's for you. You're both from the same side of the world too, I believe. So, like,
yes.
Do him a favor.
Can
I ask you a question? Is that because, like, you get like a mixed bag in a Bond film? You get action, you get romance, you get suspense, you get drama.
Yeah.
Like, it is a full palette for someone like you to paint with. Where like you're like, okay, no, we need this tone specifically here inside this box. Do not deviate. Make this. Now with Bond, it's like go.
Yeah, and it is. I think for me what the first film I saw was Live and Let Die, and I just remember for me that was one of those moments where I was just like transported. I thought this was, and the score for that, you had Paul McCartney's incredible song, you know, Live and Let Die up front. And then you have, you know, John Barry's incredible score. You know, it's iconic, the themes. There's just, you know, for me, the language of that, the language of 60s film writing is really good. And in a strange twist of fate, I'm currently working with, I can't say too much about it, but I'm currently working on a TV show that's going to drop on Netflix next year.
Nice.
That is all in that kind of throwback 60s and a lot of that Bond reference as part of the storyline is there. So I'm kind of getting to do a little bit.
You're
little
adjacent.
Bit of it.
You're in the ballpark.
We're adjacent. It's a really cool project we're actually finishing up. I'm co-scoring with Tyler, but that drops next year. And, it's giving me a little bit of that satisfaction, but I think that would definitely be one, you know, that would definitely be one type of film that I'd love to score. I'm also a huge fan of, like, I love really poignant artistic dramatic films. You know, that's another area that I really enjoy scoring, and I haven't gotten to do a ton of those. The ones that I do get to do, you know, have been like Walking with the Enemy is a film, again, that was one of those ones that I thought was, it, you know, it had Ben Kingsley in it and Jonas Armstrong, and it's a very poignant story about the guy who disguises himself in the Second World War to help Jews escape from Germany. And he always risks, he's Jewish, but he pretends to be a German officer, and he creates these false papers and is at risk through the entire film of getting caught and discovered. And it's based on a true story.
Wow.
And again, it was it's a really poignant drama. I got to score it at Abbey Road, and the score turned out great, but the film never really had a wide distribution. I think, again, it's sort of lost and buried somewhere in Netflix. The film is good. It's not it's not as fabulous as it would have needed to have been to really, I think, break out. But it's definitely worth a watch. It's very moving and has some very powerful scenes. But I like films that kind of hit a bit deeper, and can be more, a little bit more poignant in that way. And Swearing Jar is definitely in that zone. And in a strange way, I think Get Out is also a little bit in that. There's a lot of, I think, understated emotion in Get Out. Like, the stories, obviously it's a horror story, but there's a lot of emotional struggling that he goes through that film.
He's in denial, he's in fear, he's in anger, revenge. Like, there's a lot of emotional uptick in that, for sure.
Yeah, so those types of films are ones that I enjoy. So I think, again, if there's a film that I could connect with that had that as an approach. That said, I don't know. I mean, Hobbs and Shaw, that and Deadpool 2 were two really fun films to work on. And there's just, like, for me,
you're
there's
blowing shit up. It's awesome.
You know, the most recent film I orchestrated was Day Shift, which just dropped on Netflix.
Yeah. It's like 4 days old, right?
And again, I mean, that is just a great film to have a blast with. You know, you've got vampires, you're killing vampires, and those films are fun. And there is something about when you're working on films, you do tend to often inhabit the emotion of the film, because you have to write from a place where you're connecting with that. And so that's one of the things I love about when I'm working on comedies, is I'm sitting there with kind of a smile on my face, but you know, my wife knows when I'm working on, like, a deep, dark, depressing film, because I'm grumpy and depressed, and you know,
and your work has to come home with you, because you gotta do it on couch.
Right. Exactly. So
is it, like, what's that for comedy? I mean, you got to do a little bit for What We Do in the Shadows, if I'm not mistaken, right? Like, when you're watching a funny thing happen, I can imagine notes become sounds, maybe more than they're actually put together to form something beautiful. Like, you, the comedic timing, the tuba, for example, super funny sound,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Trombone, well, super funny sound. Even like, you know, like brushing up against the strings of a violin the right way, super funny sound.
Well, that I think is always the challenge of comedy, because comedy is actually quite difficult to score. There's two ways to go with it. One is to create music that feels somewhat amusing. You know, there's that famous section, you know, that did some music for in Guardians, where they're going down, they're getting interviewed, and he does the middle finger thing, and it's basically giving a description of all the characters. You know.
Yep.
And it's this kind of pizzicato thing with some finger cymbals, and it's the Guardians theme, but it's boom, chum, chum, you know. And so there's, you can go that route of creating music that inherently puts a smile on your face and sounds funny. But there's another way to go, which I often do, which I find in some ways even funnier, which is where you put incredibly earnest music against a funny sequence, where the music is taking itself so seriously, and in a way that was like History of Future Folk kind of plays it that way. But there's been a bunch of, like, comedies and things like that, and in fact this Netflix series I'm working on right now that drops next year is an outrageous adult animated comedy, so it's really funny. And again, so often what we'll do is play the reality of the scene and let the absurdity of the comedy and the situation they're in be the humor, but the music's earnest. It's like, yes, you're right there in the middle of all of this, you know.
Yeah, no, I get it. That's isn't that how they say it? Like, if you're going to do comedy, play it straight, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I mean, your music is as like, straight as your character. Like if you're committing like Shakespeare to a comedy, then it's even funnier because the character don't get their own shit.
That's right. When you look at Steve Carell or Ricky Gervais, they play it very, very straight ahead. Larry David, I mean, all that stuff is just played. I mean, Larry David's a great example where he uses the comedic music, but he's playing everything very straight for
Flipped.
It's flipped. It's exactly flipped. And the music there is very helpful because it lets the audience know that this is not meant to be taken seriously. Actually, it's pivotal in that series because most of what he does is so highly offensive that if it didn't have that lighthearted music, I don't know that he'd get away with a lot of the stuff that he says and does.
You have to have a healthy dose of like lorazepam after that to calm down. Just from all the fucking anxiety of all the shit.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I think a lot of that with Deadpool 2 was, I think was part of the approach with that was to really play it over the top serious.
Where the X-Men arrival scene. And then he comes running out in the training shirt and it's this big fanfare arrival. And it's like for an idiot, you know, okay. I know what you're talking about.
And funnily enough, that's one of the scenes I wrote. The music.
I was listening to that one too.
But that was sort of the part. There's the, you know, like another scene again, that I did some music for was when he's a baby and he's getting out of his chair and he's standing up and you know, he's got no legs, they're growing back and he's got like, kind of, you see his butt and the diaper and all of that, but he's making this big rallying speech, you know? So again, the music there is played very earnestly, very heroically, like he's rallying everybody to his cry, but the visuals are of his butt in a diaper with these baby legs as he's walking forward saying, "We will conquer," you know?
I'm telling you right now, I will never look at a comedy the same way again because I will be listening for how amazing the music is against how dumb the dick and fart joke that's taking place on screen.
To do it though, because you don't want to play it funny, you want to play it earnest, and it works. Although one of the things that we did that was pretty funny was there's this scene where they're fighting the Juggernaut, and you know, one of the things I'll do and have pretty much done since 300 is when I'm orchestrating some of these cues, I will add, you know, you don't want to have Latin lyrics, you don't want to have obvious words. So I use these made up languages for these different things. They're not a real language, but you don't want to have Latin. You want to have something, you know, like, you know, for the 300, it was sort of Chernobyl, you know, and so I'd sort of, you know, I just use syllables that sound good, like krach, chich, slach, you know, it's sort of slightly Klingon-esque.
Yeah.
And then in Deadpool 2, we'd created this, Hande, Rossi, Konsta, Kinka, you know, it was like this sort of made up thing. And David Leitch, the director, was like, is there a way we could actually be a little subversive and have these lyrics say holy shit balls, holy shit balls. So there's a great piece of footage I have of us sitting there dictating to the choir, we've got a word change here, it's going to be holy shit balls. You know, he's a big motherfucker, you know, he's the Juggernaut, you know. And so we sat there and record, and it's funny because at the end of the movie in the end credits, you actually just hear the choir singing, you know, as the final credits are going down, you hear them singing the holy shitballs, holy shitballs, oh, it was, I mean, talk about a choir, like trying to get takes of that was hysterical because they couldn't keep a straight face. They'd start singing, you can't stop him, he's the Juggernaut. You can't stop this motherfucker, you know, and that's what they're singing. And so, yeah, it was really difficult to record it because we get through like halfway through a take and the whole choir would immediately, and again, they're singing it super earnestly. That was a lot of fun. There are moments like that when you're working that are just priceless. You know, I'll treasure those moments forever because they were, you know, we were there on the Fox scoring stage with a group of, I think we had the 24 I learned my lesson from 300. I think we were down to like 24, reasonable amount.
Yeah.
Wouldn't go crazy about, but we've got 24
singers. I think I sent you like 100 questions. So don't feel bad about putting too much in.
But yeah, that was definitely one of those moments.
That's a famous scoring stage too. That's been there for a while.
Yeah, Foxes. You know, in terms of scoring stages, that for me was again sort of bucket lists of, I'd love to go onto a scoring stage and have a huge group of musicians come to play my music. And I remember when I first moved to LA, it was like that was kind of the dream. And Fox is amazing. I mean, LA has some incredible stages. We've got the Fox stage, we've got the Sony stage, which is also called the Barbra Streisand stage, but Sony's gorgeous. We have the Warner stages. Warner's is slightly smaller, but it's got a beautiful sound. I orchestrated Castle, the TV show for Raw. Okay. And so we did a lot of we had smaller groups in there to do the TV stuff, but it really sounds great, you know. And then in London, you've got Abbey Road and Air. I haven't done as much in Air. I think I did the Neil Marshall film Doomsday we worked on at Air. I like Air a lot, but Abbey Road, there's something there's something incredible about that room. You walk in and you
played on a Beatles piano, sir.
I think your
bucket list is full. Just saying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And same with Pink Floyd. They did their, there's still gear there from that period of time. It's so rich in history.
Do you have a go-to list of things in your mind when you like after a while you make so many cues and so many bars that some of that stuff I'm sure sticks and then hangs around and then you reuse it. Do you have a go-to base, like a palette of maybe one or two things? Are you string heavy first? Are you brass? Where does your love lie?
Yeah. So one of the programs I found, I used to work primarily in Pro Tools, and everything ends up in Pro Tools for mix. But for a while I used a program called Cubase, but recently I've switched to a program called Logic, which if you own a Mac, you probably have a version of it. Like GarageBand is basically like a slightly less, fancy version of Logic.
Yeah, totally.
Very similar. The way it works is quite similar. And one of the advantages of Logic is that it doesn't load any sounds in until you need them. So I have a 700 track template that I open up is ready to go, but it doesn't slow anything down because until I click on something, it just loads it in as like it's there if you need it.
Oh wow!
So what's useful about that is that any kind of sound that I might need for a cue is available to me pretty much at all times. I click on it; it takes a couple seconds, and it loads the sound in, and I go. So I have a couple of, like, if I'm doing something that's with strings, usually what I'll do is I'll go to, a couple of my favorite just general patches where I can sit here at the keyboard and just kind of sketch some stuff out with strings. I find that's a really great way because you sort of have to start by sketching it out. One of the things with film scoring is it's so time dependent. So I'm going, okay, I want to start the cue here, but I want to hit this moment here. So I have to have tempos that land that bar exactly on that frame of film.
Wow.
So I put in all my markers, like, so it needs to pick up here. It needs, then this is where the axe falls. So I need to strike that moment. Then things start to quieten down and, that the cue needs to sort of dissipate here and be gone by then. So I create the tempo framework first and listen to the speed of it to make sure that the pulse of the click feels right against it, that the pulse of just a click feels right against the scene, that it's matching. And then I'll start sketching in with, usually I might start with strings, unless it's a rhythm section driven cue, in which case I'll always start with drums. Often if it's an action cue, I'll start with more of a the drums and the percussion, because I want to get the cadence of what the groove is going to feel like. But if it's, you know, again, sometimes if it's more of a, like a horror film or a film where it needs some kind of texture, I might start with some synth that just, it starts to evoke a nice tone for what the scene is going to be. So it really sort of depends, but often if I'm having to do something thematic, I'll start with the strings and sketch it out. Once I like the general idea of the sketch, that's when I kind of then start to go in and I'll open up a violin patch and play just what the violins are going to play. I'll open up a viola patch and put that in. I'll open up a cello patch and put that in. Open up a bass patch, put that in. And then I even have like a really great string brass combination general patch, which sounds fantastic. You push it and it's this epic brass with strings, and that I find that really, like for the Deadpool stuff, that was really helpful because I could very quickly get these kind of big epic statements down. And vice versa, if I'm looking for something like, say, Swearing Jar, where I wanted these much more kind of transparent textures of strings, there's a library I have for that where you kind of hold a chord and it just sort of fades in and fades out automatically and just is very shimmery and transparent. With Brightburn, a lot of it was sitting there with, there's a company in Bristol, these guys who've made this incredible library. You hear it a lot over Johann Johannes's scores, but it's these incredible sort of organic synths that you hold down and it's this kind of texture, and they're made from organic instruments like woodwinds or strings, but they're distorted and they've been manipulated in a way that makes them feel very otherworldly. And you're also playing them sort of maybe several octaves too low so that they sound like they don't sound recognizable. And they program them so that you can actually pitch bend them and change the filters on them so that they can kind of open up and close like a synth. Those are very inspiring for creating those kind of tones and those scenes where you just want that sense of something's going to happen, but you don't necessarily want it to be recognizable as a string. You want it to feel tense, but without being, oh, this is a string section.
I'm so blown away that you look at film and hear music. Like that's the crazy thing to me, is that your mind knows where to tell your fingers, that you know what sounds belong to this. And I can only imagine that heightens your enjoyment of film, because the marriage of film and music, they're bedfellows. You cannot have one without the other if you're trying to have a motion picture.
Yeah. And it's, unfortunately, it's one of those things I can't help but listen to if I'm watching a film. If the music sucks, really difficult to watch the film. But more often than not, I'll watch a film and I'll go, oh man, that's gorgeous. I wonder who scored it. So I'll be sitting there, you know, instead of watching
nerding
the film,
out. Yeah.
No. And who's done this one? Oh yeah. You know, that's great.
That's how I find people to talk to, is I'm like, oh, I really like this. Or, oh, I know these people, they make good stuff. Like, let's see if they'll say hello to a fanboy out in Winnipeg, which you're full of so, like, it's I would love to keep you longer, I really would, but such is life. I have to get back to being an adult, and there's, you know, crap I gotta do instead of, you know, talk about Guardians of the Galaxy with the guy who makes the music for it. I told you before I let you go that what's the next thing that you can talk about? What's the one thing you can talk about right now? Is it what's the title again?
Day Shift.
Day Shift. Or, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Day Shift has dropped. And you'll enjoy it. If you haven't seen it, it's a Jamie Foxx film. I think it's number one on Netflix right now. It's just a really fun film. So, I'm pretty sure it's available up in Canada.
I saw it. It's on my radar, actually.
Yeah, but it's just a fun. It's a really fun film. Like it's one of those. They modeled it after kind of like a '90s, you know, vampire killing fun film. You know, like an action comedy. So it has a fun lightness to it that I actually haven't seen in a lot of films for a while. But in terms of what's opening for me, Swearing Jar and Pearl are probably the two biggest things coming down the pipeline for me. And then, and unfortunately, I can't talk about this this Netflix series, but I think it's going to be pretty big, and I think people are really going to enjoy it because it is a animated comedy, but it's very R-rated humor, and the premise is brilliant. It's a really clever premise, so I'm excited to share that with you. Maybe in about 5 or 6 months. We can circle back and go through that, but it's a pretty cool series that I'm really interested to see how it does. You know, I think people will either be highly offended by it or just adore it. You know, so speaking of,
I hope for both.
Doing those things that I shouldn't be doing. This is high. It's very high on the list of like. a project that it's a lot of fun. So
that's awesome. Well, as soon as it drops, I would love to have you back to talk more. Like you're like a 3-part episode, dude. Like the stuff I could talk to you. I didn't even get half the shit in. So, but, thank you so much for doing this. You have a home here with us whenever you got something coming out.
Yeah. Fantastic. And great to meet with you and chat with you. Real pleasure.
Thank you so much, sir. I'm just a nerd who bought a microphone. And apparently had the voice for it. So with that said, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. You got way more than I thought we'd get. Tim Williams is the shit. Go watch everything he's done and listen more when you're watching it now because it's going to sound different. It's going to feel different because you know how the sausage was made, so to speak. If you want to find out more about Tim, if you know him and you want to reach out to him, all of his information will be in the show notes. I've been Michael Petro. My guest has been Tim Williams from Victoria, BC, by way of Surrey. Right, Surrey? I did some research.
Yes, you're right.
Say bye, Tim.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, pleasure, dude. Bye, everybody.
Spanish ladies.
And just like that, ladies and gentlemen, another Real Debaters production is in the can. Thank you so much for listening. If this is your first, second, third, fifth, 20th time, thank you so much. But thank you to the first timers, the ones here who pressed play for the first time and took a gamble on us. If you like what you heard today, the easiest thing to support the show is just to subscribe. Hit the like button, the follow button, whatever's in your podcast player. Make it so that we're always there every Wednesday for you, okay? That would be huge. If you want to stay in touch with us, if you want to follow us, there's a couple ways to do that. We're on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Facebook. We're slowly migrating to YouTube by putting all of the things we've ever put on video onto that site. There's some surprises coming this year that happened a while ago, but I felt needed to be shared because they're part of the Debaterverse. So the YouTube page is coming. But if you want to follow us, it's at Real Debaters Pod on Twitter and Instagram. It's the Real Debaters Podcast on TikTok. All of the links, all of the one-click-away things are in the show notes that you've just listened to. So if you want to follow us there, that would be great too, because then you get to stay in the know of all the things that we do and what we're going to try to do this year and what we've done in the past, so on and so forth. So that's how you stay in touch with us. If you want to contact us, it's therealdebaters@gmail.com. All the spelling for all these things is R-E-E-L to keep with the title of the show. So you can send an email to us there, request an episode, want to call out one of us for being a goofball. There's places to do that as well too. Like the Real Debaters website, you can email us or you can go straight to the website, rate us in Podchaser, therealdebaters.ca. And if you really, really liked what you heard and you want to support the show in some fashion that requires you spending money, well, we got a couple ways for you to do that as well, too. You can buy our merch at the Prop Shop. It's a store through Threadless, and it's online, and you can order stuff. We've got tons of stuff. We've got our Mass Debater wear there. It's our signature, original, and only line. It's all of our, it's our logo on everything. So you can support us that way. Go to the merch tab in the show notes. Or if you just got a buck and you're like, hey, I want to give you a buck and donate it to your cause, there is a tab in the show notes as well, too, that says donate to the Debaterverse, I think. And if you click on that, well, it takes you to a donation page where you can donate like $1, $3, and $5, and you'll get something for your $1, $3, or $5. Any more than that's just ludicrous. Luda. So, yeah, that's just kind of what I wanted to tell you, that what I said at the end of the show. This is what you should listen to, because this is all about who we are. And now that we've gotten to where we are, we want to interact with you guys more. So these are the ways to do so. This is the way to stay in touch with us. Thank you to everybody again who's listened to the show. Again, you pressed play. You took a chance. That's cool. So without further ado, this is where I said I would talk more. So it's eggs on your face. No, I got nothing else for you. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. And watch all them fucking movies. Bye-bye.